thing as being too Jewish.
Thank you very much.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Elizabeth Gonzalez-James, author of the new novel, The Bullet Swallower. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. The opinions of the host and guests on Two Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. Two Jewish is paid for by Two Jewish Radio Programs and Podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Well, just in time for Passover this year, and most unexpectedly, the number one streaming series on Netflix this week is not a reality TV show on finding love. It's not a cooking show. It's not a detective show or a murder show or even a teen drama with supernatural overtones. Nope. The number one show on Netflix this week, actually for several weeks now, is called Testament, The Story of Moses. My wife Sophie and I tried to watch it one night last week and found it to be pretty weak. It's not exactly a drama, since it has experts, that is, talking heads, opining about Moses and the Exodus story, but it's also not quite a documentary, since it has dramatizations of the events of the greatest story ever told. I'm sorry. For you Jesus fans, the slavery, plagues narrative, Exodus from Egypt, parting of the Red Sea tale is far more dramatic, at least potentially, and much better plotted than, you know, your story. But anyway, this Netflix show has weird dramatizations and mediocre CGI recreations of the high points of the story mixed in with various experts' commentary. I'm not sure exactly what they're trying to convey, but I do know that we didn't make it through two full episodes before falling asleep, and we tried on two consecutive nights. Look, I'm glad the Moses thing is popular, especially this time of year. We've had to depend on the hokey and profoundly outdated Cecil B. DeMille biblical epic The Ten Commandments film with Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner for almost 70 years. 70, if you are keeping track in a biblical scorecard. Or the animated Prince of Egypt movie that was made in 1998 by DreamWorks. Even that one is over 25 years old now. There was a wretched version of the story called Exodus, Gods and Kings with Christian Bale that Ridley Scott made 10 years ago that was, to be kind, unwatchably terrible. So when this miniseries popped up on our Netflix menu as the number one show in the country, well, we had to view it. And this one? Not great. Not even good. We found it pretty hard to stay awake, which is a shame and, frankly, somewhat startling. I mean, it's astonishing how many terrible films and TV shows are made out of fantastic biblical stories. I find it puzzling that producers and directors, given great plots, terrific characters, even memorable dialogue in the original sources, somehow cannot make a decent movie or TV series out of these extraordinary stories that shaped all later literature, not to mention fostering three major religions and most of Western civilization. Look, the Exodus story is terrific. It has everything you could possibly want in a dramatic epic, even a bit of sex appeal in the Moses Tzipora romance. It's got the struggle for freedom from enslavement and oppression, the rise of a very reluctant and unexpected hero, a powerful, evil, and deceitful king defeated by a resistance movement, a series of supernatural plagues, miraculous redemption, finally a national covenant and identity affirmed. The Exodus story can be seen as the struggle between the ancient pantheons of corrupt gods and a new unified moral god, There are twists and turns in the plot enough to satisfy any great dramatist and certainly any audience. It's a magnificent tale. And the movies and TV shows they make from it are, generally speaking, very pale imitations of the original text. This Netflix series is no exception. Testament, the story of Moses' popularity is rather shocking in view of the fact that everybody seems to think that religion is just fading away in America these days. Yet many people are glued to their streaming devices, you know, TVs, phones, laptops, tablets, whatever, watching a less than compelling telling of this extremely ancient tale in a not very interesting way. Somehow, viewers seem to still appreciate a rip-roaring biblical classic, even when it's poorly made. I guess, well, you can't always watch, I don't know, cooking shows? I have also never understood why they can't manage to make a great movie about King David, by the way. Now that should be a great film, or an even better streaming series. I mean, David starts out as a handsome shepherd boy. He unexpectedly slays a giant, becomes a rock star singer, songwriter, performer, marries a princess, turns into the best warrior in the region, is forced into exile. He becomes a successful outlaw, leading a gang, you know, kind of like Butch Cassidy, returns when the old king gets killed in battle to become a wildly successful king himself and a conqueror. Has romantic entanglements, including with other guys' wives, captures a new capital city, builds a big palace, has to defeat rebellions by his own sons, and eventually passes the unified kingdom on to his son, by which time this David guy is a legend. Now that's a story you should be able to pitch to industry executives. Yet, every movie they've ever made about David is so bad it is painful to watch. In any case, while I appreciate people are watching the Moses series, I hope that as we approach Pesach, the season of freedom, at least some of you folks will pick up the original text, that is, the first 20 chapters or so of Exodus. Reread the original, maybe in a contemporary translation. Safaria.org has a few good choices online for free. Exodus is simply a great original, and I promise, as usual, the book is a lot better than the movie or the TV streaming series. And so to play us in on the theme of Exodus and the upcoming Festival of Freedom, Passover, which begins with the first Seder just 2 weeks from tomorrow night, April 22nd at sundown, here's Israeli singer Gad Elbaz's version of The Four Questions.
הלילה הזה, הלילה, כולו מעצר. הלילה הזה, הלילה, כולו מעצר. מה נשתנה הלילה הזה מכל הלילות שבכל
That was Gad Elbaz singing The Four Questions. you can attend an extraordinary Passover Seder led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, at Congregation Beit Simcha on the second night of Pesach, Tuesday, April 23rd at 6 p.m. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, to sign up. As Moses said, more or less, let our people rejoice. Make this year a Seder to remember at Beit Simcha. Our guest this morning is a first-time novelist who wrote a terrific tale about the border region. It's called Improbably the Bullet Swallower. Meet Elizabeth Gonzalez-James when we come back in just a moment, right here on Too Jewish. Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award, please go to kohanaward.com, kohanaward.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Elizabeth Gonzalez-James' novel is just fantastic, highly appropriate for people who live anywhere near the borderlands, like, you know, Tucson, Arizona. It's called The Bullet Swallower. It's based on, I'll let her tell you, but a couple of people from her ancestral past. It's an extraordinary novel. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
So off air, we were talking a little bit about the fact that you started out as an opera singer, and that kind of gave you a feel for what is, I think, a very beautiful and yet powerful and sometimes very painful book.
Thank you. Yeah, I studied music from the age of 11 until 18, and I was an opera singer at Macaroni Grill, which was kind of a funny first job to have. And it taught me to really have an ear for, like, what's working, what sounds right, what doesn't sound right. And I use that all the time in my writing. I can tell when a sentence isn't quite hitting just because of how it sounds to my ear. It's, I don't know, kind of a synesthetic process that it combines like the physical act of typing and then hearing things and seeing them on the page. It's difficult to describe. I don't know if that made any sense.
No, but it's a little bit like trying to describe how music happens. I think authors are much better at describing their process than most musicians are, because for a lot of people that do music, it just kind of happens, right? There's an organic quality to it, but there's an organic quality to good writing too that sometimes is very difficult to express. So tell us a little bit about your family, because it clearly influenced the development of The Bullet Swallower.
Yeah, so The Bullet Swallower is a magical realism Western that's loosely based on the true story of my great-grandfather. He was a bandito sometime in the late 1800s, and at some point he was chased down by the Texas Rangers. They shot him in the face and left him for dead, but he lived and eventually made it back to his family in Mexico, and after that, people started calling him El Tragabalas, which in Spanish means The Bullet Swallower. So that was the seed that I used to write my novel, which is a very fictionalized account of that legend. And yeah, I used a lot of historical research, some genealogical deep dives that I did into my family, and then some imagination to kind of round it out.
It's kind of like Larry McMurtry crossed with Gabriel Garcia Marquez or something. I don't know
Thank
if you...
Thank you. That's very high praise.
Yeah, I mean, it's great. I really enjoy the book. We will talk much more. I want to talk also about your movie star ancestor and how the bullet swallower developed, and it's really complicated and fascinating plot when we come back in a moment with Elizabeth Gonzalez-James here on Too Jewish. Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a wonderful Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this spring. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha is a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. Progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. And don't forget our second Seder on April 23rd. Join us in person for Shabbat services every Friday night, 6:30 p.m. services, always followed by an Oneg Shabbat, or you can come on Facebook Live. Go to our website, BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, for more information. We welcome members and guests in our sanctuary in person. Call 520-276-5675. Religious schools available for school-age children or grandchildren. Join us in our fabulous Hebrew school, bar and bat mitzvah programs, Torah Tikes experience, confirmation, teen programs, all in a fun, relaxed setting with great Jewish learning. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Coming up fast, Tuesday night, April 23rd, our fabulous second night Seder, Let Our People Rejoice, led by me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Song, stories, reflections of freedom and what it all means, an amazing kosher for Passover food from Catalina Caterers, including prime rib or salmon. Beit Simcha's services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Come in person or join us online. Shabbat services again, 6:30 p.m. Friday night. Saturday morning, Torah studies at 9 a.m., Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m. in person, or come to all of our classes on Zoom while our services are on Facebook. For more information about Beit Simcha, to come to services, religious school and Torah Tikes programs, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation, high school programs, rich array of adult education academy courses, live and on Zoom, and of course all of our services in person and on Facebook, go to BeitSimchaTucson.org, BeitSimchaTucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 520-276-5675, BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, and the fastest growing and most dynamic Jewish congregation in all of Southern Arizona. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O, Jewish Radio 18 at gmail.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, 2JewishRadio.com, streaming us from there, or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcast, Top 10 in America. According to Moment Magazine, over 200,000 downloads on Podbean and on Spotify, too. Post a rating, review 2Jewish wherever you listen to our podcast. Those comments all help. The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of Southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470.
While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we are approaching Pesach. This is always a big time of year, and we think about freedom as the central theme, the Feast of Freedom, the Seder, the whole experience of freedom from slavery. This has not been a very good year to celebrate freedom. So many Israelis and other nationals held hostage under Gaza. Really a hard time to think about it, and maybe not at the same scale, but like Evan Gershowitz, the reporter for the Wall Street Journal, being held in Putin's Russia for more than a year on trumped-up charges of espionage. Freedom isn't happening everywhere.
Right, and since you brought up Russia, always a dangerous subject with me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, there's a legitimate question, is anybody in Russia really free?
Well, maybe Putin.
You know,
I don't know.
It's a police state. It's arbitrary. There's no rule of law. I don't know whether you have to be in jail in Russia to be deprived of your freedom. I think just being in Russia and breathing Russian air
may deprive you of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, in terms of the Jewish people and not only the hostages in Gaza, but all the people who are internally displaced in Israel because of the war in the north and Hezbollah attacks, and you know, people were removed from anywhere near the border with Gaza. Are those people free? Are displaced persons and refugees who are really homeless ever truly free? So even if you consider all those people as somehow hostage to the current situation, I think like the vast majority of Jews in the world are relatively free, depending on where we live. You know, if we live in the US or Canada or France or Germany, we're relatively
Australia,
free.
Australia, wherever we are.
Right. Right. So I think maybe the challenge this year at Passover is not only to celebrate the Exodus from Egypt, which we do every year, but also somehow to challenge ourselves to use the freedoms we have more fully and in a more productive way for the sake of the Jewish people, for the sake of humanity, for the sake of the planet. Those of us who are at liberty should fully take advantage of that liberty and appreciate it. And maybe that's the message this Pesach.
Yeah, I mean, not to focus so much on the people that have had their liberties deprived or are being deprived of liberty, but the ways in which we could use our freedom to make a difference.
Right.
Tom, thanks. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Two religious guys, Moshe and Shlomo, are discussing the state of morality in society today. One of them, Moshe, says, "I think it's shocking and shameful that so many people are having premarital sex. I never had sex with my wife before we got married. Did you?" And Shlomo answers, "I don't know. What was her maiden name?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read one of the least appetizing portions of the whole year, Tazria, in the book of Leviticus. It contains instructions on the treatment of a truly horrible ancient illness, leprosy, one that still exists in the world, although it isn't much in evidence in America these days, thank God. Tazria delineates the ways in which we are to treat those individuals afflicted with this terrible, frightening ailment that our ancestors regarded as contagious. The methods they specified, sanitary conditions and quarantine, well, those should be familiar to us. They are still in use today, often considered state-of-the-art medical means of controlling unknown infections. Nor is there any moral valence placed in the Torah on those who are ill. People infected with this dread affliction are not considered to have brought it on themselves by bad action or error. Rather, they are simply unfortunate. They are isolated for their own protection and that of the societies. In the ancient world, this was cutting-edge treatment of the infirm, far ahead of what most cultures would do even millennia later. Even in our own world, we should be aware that we rarely treat those who are gravely ill with frightening illnesses that we don't understand very well. You may remember when the AIDS epidemic began, there was a general panic about how to treat those who were infected. With no justification, many individuals were ostracized from schools, neighborhoods, society in general. And of course, just a couple of years ago when COVID hit and the coronavirus pandemic spread all around the world, our own American society managed to both panic and then arrogantly fail to act consistently or even wisely. People either became hypervigilant or lapsed into a weird denial, ridiculing the very process that kept people safer and alive. And in addition to the remarkable development of the vaccines for coronavirus and its variants that heroic researchers developed, we used kind of the same methods they prescribe in this Torah portion of Tazria: isolation, separation, quarantine, hygiene. While we know more about many medical subjects today than our ancestors did, in some ways we are probably not much more advanced than our Israelite forebears were 3,000 years ago. In this Torah portion of Tazria, they too turned to God for help, and they generally treated those who were ill with compassion and care. We should always do that today, too. When we return in a moment on To Jewish, our guest, Elizabeth Gonzalez-James, tells us how she conceived of her new book about her own outlaw ancestor, well, sort of, and her movie star relative, and how she bridged so many cultural differences. All that when she rejoins us in a moment here on To Jewish to discuss The Bullet Swallower.
We continue with our To Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
More than 2 years after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky wrote the first letter, his Israeli counterpart Isaac Herzog inked the final letters of a Torah scroll dedicated to peace in both their countries. The Torah was initiated in Ukraine shortly after Russia's 2022 invasion and completed this week in Israel, now engaged in its own war in Gaza. Along the way, letters were written by Jews serving in the Ukrainian army, members of the Jewish community in Kyiv, families of fallen Israeli soldiers, and relatives of Israelis kidnapped in Gaza, among others. The writing of this Torah, which will be brought back to Ukraine in the coming months and put in one of the synagogues in the country's capital, was an initiative of the Kyiv Chief Rabbi Yonatan Markowitz. Both Jewish presidents wrote a letter in the Sefer Torah, dedicated for the sake of peace and achdut, unity in Am Yisrael, which will be placed in Kyiv's Great Synagogue, the rabbi said, referring to Zelensky and Herzog, the world's only two Jewish heads of state. The first letter of the Sefer Torah was written by Zelensky in his office in the presidential bunker in Kyiv. Herzog wrote the final letter in a ceremony held at the official presidential residence in Jerusalem. The integration between the Jews of Israel and the Jewish community in Ukraine constitutes a powerful force multiplier for the survival and continuity of the Jewish people, Herzog said during the event. There is nothing more moving than being part of writing a Sefer Torah, symbolizing this special unity, especially now. The ceremony was attended by relatives of Zina Balin, a 60-year-old Israeli woman of Ukrainian origin, murdered October 7th in Sderot, together with a dozen other senior citizens on a bus trip she had organized. Also present at the Israeli president's residence, Markowitz talked of the story of Jewish heroism and resilience shared by the Jews of Israel and Ukraine. He thanked Jews from Israel and around the world for their assistance to Ukrainian Jews. When we began writing this Sefer Torah, we did not think we would reach a situation where our brothers, the people of Israel and the Holy Land, would also be under the threat of a cruel war, Markowitz said. In other news, last week, U.S. President Joe Biden said he was outraged and heartbroken by an Israeli airstrike that killed 7 hunger relief workers and said Israel is not doing enough to protect aid workers and other civilians. This was his sharpest official rebuke of Israel in the Gaza war so far. Biden's statement came as Israel scrambled to deal with the fallout of the killing last week of 7 workers with World Central Kitchen. Israel's acknowledged responsibility for the strike and launched an investigation, has already made changes to how it coordinates with aid agencies. Israel made those changes and apologies before Biden released his statement, but the president, nonetheless, did not hold back criticizing the Israeli government and army. This is not a standalone incident, Biden said, referring to the nearly 200 employees of humanitarian agencies who have been killed in Gaza since Hamas launched its war with its brutal attack on Israel on October 7th. This conflict has been one of the worst in recent memory in terms of how many aid workers have been killed, Biden said. It's a major reason why distributing humanitarian aid in Gaza has been so difficult. Israel has not done enough to protect aid workers trying to deliver desperately needed help to civilians. Incidents like yesterday's simply should not happen. Israel has not done enough to protect civilians. In informal exchanges with reporters, Biden in the past has criticized Israel's conduct of the war, at one point saying its bombing was over the top. But the anguish and anger he expressed was notable because it came in a formal statement. President Biden has backed Israel from the outset of the war, when Hamas terrorists massacred more than 1,200 people and abducted more than 250 in a horrific Palestinian terrorist atrocity. But more recently, Biden has openly criticized Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's direction of the war, particularly his plans to launch a massive operation in Rafah, the city on the Gaza-Egypt border where more than 1 million Palestinians have taken refuge. Netanyahu says that 4 Hamas battalions remain in Rafah, and that the war will not be over until the terrorist group is dismantled. The Biden administration has pressed Israel to facilitate the entry of humanitarian assistance into the Gaza Strip. Israel has blamed the obstruction of assistance on Hamas, which has also stolen much of the earlier humanitarian aid and used it for its own purposes. President Biden said the U.S. would continue to impose costs on Russia for its imprisonment of his Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovitz, who was arrested almost exactly a year ago. The Wall Street Journal marked the March 29th anniversary by leaving most of its front page empty below a headline reading, "His story should be here." Every other article and headline on the front page involved Evan Gershkovitz. Today we mark a painful anniversary, 1 year of American journalist Evan Gershkovitz's wrongful detention in Russia, President Biden said. As I said to Evan's parents, I will never give up hope. We will continue working every day to secure his release. We will continue to denounce and impose costs for Russia's appalling attempts to use Americans as bargaining chips. Gershkovitz, the 32-year-old American son of Jewish immigrants from the Soviet Union, has been held on espionage charges since March 29, 2023. He was arrested by Russian agents while on a reporting trip in the city of Yekaterinburg. Gershkovitz, the U.S. government, and the Wall Street Journal deny all the allegations for which the Russian government has provided no evidence at all. Gershkovitz's arrest came amid an ongoing crackdown on the press in Russia during its war on Ukraine. On January 30th, a Moscow court extended Gershkovitz's detention. Gershkovich has yet to be tried. If he is convicted, he would face up to 20 years in a penal colony, and Russian courts always convict. Biden imposed sanctions on Russia's Internal Security Service, the FSB, about a month after Gershkovich was detained. It has also imposed multiple sanctions since then related to the Ukraine war and the other malfeasance by the Putin regime. Both Russia and the U.S. have floated the possibility of a prisoner exchange, but a deal has not materialized. Jewish organizations and activists have taken up Gershkovich's cause, at times employing Jewish ritual to call for his release in ways that echo the Soviet Jewry movement of decades ago. Last Pesach, Passover, Seder tables around the world often included an empty seat, symbolizing Gershkovich's imprisonment. Jewish federations spearheaded a campaign last year to send him letters before Rosh Hashanah. In the Wall Street Journal, a four-page section was dedicated entirely to Evan Gershkovich, as were in-house advertisements elsewhere in the newspaper. "This story cannot be written," said an ad taking up a quarter of one page. Also calling for Gershkovich's release was a rare bipartisan statement from both Democratic and Republican leaders in the Senate and the House of Representatives. It said, 45 years ago, Evan's parents, Ella and Mikhail Gershkovich, found refuge in the U.S. after fleeing the Soviet Union. The statement was issued in the name of House Speaker Mike Johnson, Louisiana Republican, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, a New York Democrat, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a New York Democrat, who is Jewish, and Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican. Today, Putin is restoring Soviet-style control through repression at home and aggression abroad. On the anniversary of Evan Gershkovich's captivity, we reaffirm the importance of his work. Journalism is not a crime. Reporters are not bargaining chips. The Kremlin's attempts to silence Evan and intimidate other Western reporters will not impede the pursuit of truth. As we approach this season of freedom, we hope and pray for Gershkovich's release, as well as the release of all the Israeli hostages still held by the Palestinian terrorists of Hamas. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Elizabeth Gonzalez-James is a novelist. She's the author of a previous novel, Mona at Sea, a book, Five Conversations About Peter Sellers. Her stories have appeared in a variety of literary journals. She's won a number of Pushcart Prize and Best of the Net nominations. Her new book is called The Bullet Swallower. It's a fascinating and challenging tale. And we talked a little bit earlier about how it's based on this bandido ancestor of yours. And let's talk a little bit about the movie star who, very prominent Mexican movie star, really part of your family, who actually did a movie that was kind of loosely based on this story.
Yeah. So a cousin of mine on my father's side was the huge movie star in Mexico, Lalo Gonzalez. In Mexico, everybody gets a nickname, so people know him more as El Piporro. So he was Mexico's top grossing movie star of 1964. And that same year, he wrote and starred in a movie called El Tragabalas. And the story that I heard growing up was that he went to my grandfather, asked him for his blessing to write a movie about my great-grandfather. My grandfather refused. He did it anyway, and my grandfather was cheesed off at him for, like, the rest of his life. But when I actually tried to verify this, and my cousin Lalo Gonzalez had written an autobiography. He's deceased now. He had written an autobiography. I read it, and this story is nowhere in that book. Then I watched the movie that he made, and it has nothing whatsoever to do with my great-grandfather. It's just kind of about this, like, roving do-gooder who happens to be called the Bullet Swallower, but he doesn't even have a scar. So I have no idea what happened. And he's dead. My grandfather's dead. Everybody's dead. I can't ask anybody any follow-up questions. It was originally my intention to tell exactly that story of the betrayal of making this movie. But then when I couldn't corroborate it, I was like, well, okay, I'll think of something else. And eventually the book just got further and further and further away from fact. And I was like, you know what? I don't actually have to follow any kind of actual truth here. I can just make anything up that I want. It is a novel after all. And so I ended up doing that. And so I say in my author's note, I was initially inspired by my cousin's story, but what actually happens in the book is complete fantasy. And like, I don't want to get sued, and I don't want anybody to mistake my very famous cousin for this fictional person that I invented.
Yes, I can understand that. Look, it's definitely a novel. There's a complexity to any Borderlands area. That is particularly true in one that becomes politicized, like the Mexican-American border. Tell us a little bit about your own feelings about that.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up in Laredo, Texas, so we were 5 minutes from the border for the first 10 years of my life. And I also grew up there in the 80s and the early 90s when there was a lot of crime, but it was very easy to cross. You didn't have to be as worried as you do today with all the violence and kidnapping and stuff. And also you didn't need a passport. You just would walk across. You would literally park your car. There was a mall. There's still a mall where you cross in Laredo. So you park your car and you just walk across the bridge and there you are. And I went to Catholic school when I was young. I've since converted to Judaism, but I always give this anecdote. Like half of the kids at my Catholic school lived in Mexico and they commuted across every day to go to school. My dad's dentist was in Mexico. I had family over there. Like, people don't live on one side of the border or the other. All of that area was Mexico. And the fact that in the 1800s, an international boundary was declared, like, didn't necessarily change the way that people had been living in that part of the country for hundreds of years. And I'm not a pundit. I'm not a policymaker. I don't have any solution, for what's going on now. But what I can offer to the conversation is that the border is a very fluid place. It's a very complicated place. People live on both sides, and trying to wall off a community of people that sees itself as one community, it doesn't work. I mean, ask Berlin. So, yeah.
The Bullet Swallower book, it comes back and forth across the border all over the place, right? I mean, and it shows that it's kind of it's its own region, and it's not exactly Mexico, it's not exactly America, it's kind of both. That influences the development of the book, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. And I knew that I wanted to tell this story, and I originally was just focused on telling the kind of swashbuckling bandito tale of revenge that, you know, I initially cooked up, where this guy is shot in the face by the Texas Rangers and he vows to get back at them for what they did. But, you know, then in setting it along the border and in doing all of my research and into what was going on in the region at the time and the kind of people who were living there, you know, it slowly starts dawning on me, well, I'm going to have to talk a lot about the border and what that is. And I get the privilege, actually, of inserting my own kind of informed opinion on this, having grown up there. And my parents still live in Corpus Christi, which is 2 hours from the border, and I'm back there all the time. And yeah, you're right. As you say, like, it isn't exactly the United States. And it's not exactly Mexico. It's this like blurry in-between place, especially Laredo, where you can definitely go out to eat and encounter people who do not speak English, who do not, they don't need English to get through their day, even though they live in the United States. Maybe they were born in the United States. So I think expressing that, you know, became more apparent to me the deeper into the book that I got. And then too, I started writing it in the summer of 2016. And so after Donald Trump was elected, and then I started hearing people, you know, screaming, build the wall and deport them and all this stuff, I'm writing my reactions to all this anti-immigrant rhetoric in real time into the book. It's all in there. You know, it's contextualized within the historical time period of the novel, but I know what I was writing, you know, was a direct response to what I'm seeing, you know, on CNN that morning.
Sure, sure. This is maybe a little bit coming around the corner, but I'm thinking about the fact that Passover is coming up. It's a time of freedom. And freedom means responsibility. And in this book, there's a lot of reflection on what it means to be free of hunger, free of fear, and yet having to fight for all of those things. This isn't just a simple good and evil or even a revenge story, is it?
No, not at all. And I opened the book with my bandito's grandfather, who is a heinous individual and commits a terrible crime against this native tribe of people who were living in Mexico. And that was to really acknowledge that, you know, the Texans, the Mexicans living in Texas were treated horribly by the white people who moved into Texas and in a lot of cases stole their land. But likewise, the native people were treated horribly by the Spanish people.
Yeah, absolutely.
As well. And it's like, I talk a lot about time moving in a circle, these spirals and these kind of like pain begetting pain. And it's just like, how many times do we have to see the same story play out of like, of people just completely subjugating another group of people because they, because they have the gun. I was very aware of that. And it's a really complicated lineage. Being Mexican American is like, in some ways, to have to acknowledge that you are both conqueror and conquered. It's unsettling. Yeah, it's uncomfortable.
There's an interesting book within the book. I kind of want to touch on that. I don't think I'm giving away anything. The ignominious history of the Sonoro family from antiquity to present day, and how it traces the origins of this Bandito family back to Cain. It's very interesting. Like that's a fascinating device. How did you decide to use that?
Yeah. A while back, like 2019, I started flipping these little historical snippets into the beginnings of chapters. So sometimes it would be a full paragraph, sometimes it would just be a sentence, and it was just kind of like a thematic, like, okay, now we're going to talk about something that happens along the Rio Grande. But for people who don't know that area, I'm going to give you a little bit of geographic or historical setting up just so that you know what I'm talking about. And eventually, like, it wasn't really working to start every chapter that way. But I can't remember how I had the idea to just make it all part of one fake history book. you know, maybe it was...
I don't think you should call it fake. I think you should call it imagined.
Yeah, yeah. It might have been Borges. He does a lot of that, you know, where he's like, I found this encyclopedia that it has the history of everything that ever happened.
Yeah, or Umberto Eco or somebody like that.
Yeah, or even George Saunders in Lincoln and the Bardo had a ton of imagined found text.
Yeah.
So I don't know, like who's influenced, but I do love Borges and George Saunders. And yeah, once I decided to make it one book, and then I pulled back a little bit, and I was like, well, who's writing this book? Who is this person? Why is she writing it? And then as later on in The Bullet Swallower, we see in the excerpts of the book, she, the author of this fake book, starts flipping a little bit into the first person and describing her motivation for writing her history of the family. And that was so fun because I got to use her a little bit as a mouthpiece for me and, you know, kind of explain, like, I had really big ambitions for this book. I'm not sure that they were fulfilled. I did the best that I could. And my editor, you know, as we were working, he was like, well, people are going to assume that's you. And I was like, yeah, it is me. I'm talking to the reader right there. I'm saying, like, this was a big project, y'all, and hopefully it worked out.
Well, I think it worked out beautifully. It's a terrific read. It's a great read anytime. Definitely be a good summer read. And for anybody living anywhere in the Southwest or really anywhere in the country, I think it's really a terrific book. The book is called The Bullet Swallower. Elizabeth, where can people go to find out more about you and more about the book?
Yeah, absolutely. I have a website, ElizabethGonzalezJames.com, and that's Gonzalez with a Z.
Two Z's, in fact.
Yes, exactly. And I'm on Instagram, probably on
Twitter
platforms.
And Facebook, and I don't know. Elizabeth, thanks so much. Happy Passover, Chag Sameach in advance, and we look forward to your next project, too.
Thank you so much, Chag Sameach, and thank you for having me.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
The stories we share last a lifetime and are passed down from generation to generation. Known for our compassionate commitment to the families we serve, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has faithfully served the Tucson community and the Jewish community for over 100 years. We help thousands of families plan and carry out celebrations of loved ones in unique and special ways and assist them in sharing those lifetimes of stories meaningfully. The most beautiful and tranquil final resting place in all of southern Arizona, Evergreen's tall pines shade peaceful grassy fields. You can count on Evergreen for superior service and the highest degree of integrity. Our informative, well-trained staff is here to assist you with a full range of on-site services. Call Evergreen, 520-888-7470, 520-888-7470. While we serve the whole community, our experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. We have sections dedicated to all religious faiths, can help you arrange for your future needs or your immediate ones. Whether you choose to hold a traditional funeral service or a completely individualized ceremony, either in person or online or both, our goal is to help you create a meaningful, personalized service based upon your unique needs in a place of reflection, tradition, and serenity. Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best to the community and to you. Call 520-888-7470. To speak to a family advisor at Evergreen, call 520-888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week. Our guest will be New York Times bestselling author Caroline Levitt, author of the new book, Days of Wonder. Fascinating book about a young murderer who has paid her debt to society, and yet there are complications. And join us at Congregation Beit Simcha each Friday night for services and Onig Shabbat at 6:30 p.m., Saturday morning too, 9 a.m. Torah study, 10 a.m. services and Kiddush. Live in person and on our Facebook page, definitely sign up now for our magnificent second night Seder at Beit Simcha. Let our people rejoice. Go to BeitSimchaTucson.org to register. Our playout today comes from Israeli-Moroccan icon Yehoram Gaon, a Sephardic version of Adir Hu from the songs at the Passover Seder. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, a healthy week, and a week we pray profoundly of justice and peace.
Adir Hu, Adir Hu, Yiven Beito Bekarov, Bimhera, Beyaminu Bekarov, El Bene, Bene Beitcha Bekarov, Bimhera, Beyaminu Bekarov. Adir Hu, Adir Hu, Yiven Beito Bekarov, Bimhera, Beyaminu Bekarov, El Bene, Bene Beitcha Bekarov, Bimhera.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.